an apartment out there. And the optical business slacked off at the end of the war, but the instrument activity picked up and became the major activity of the company.
And when you joined, who was heading up the IR effort?
I don't think, let's see, it was mostly a fellow named Dick Kinnaird, who was a mechanical designer, and McCarthy, who was Dick Perkins' brother-in-law.
Hmm.
But they were engineers. They had no marketing affiliation or anything of that sort. And the instrument business kind of grew because all of a sudden PerkinElmer discovered they had a bear by the tail, really. They were getting so many orders for this instrument. And then we learned later that it was due to two programs. It was the synthetic rubber program, where they needed to measure the butadiene ratio, and they could do it beautifully by means of infrared. And the other was the atomic bomb program, where apparently infrared was a very important tool that they were using as part of that program. When the first bomb went off, we were dealing with a purchasing group in New York City that we didn't know who they were, except they had very high priority. Every time they called up and wanted an instrument, they got the next one off the assembly line. And it turned out that they were the purchasing group for the atomic energy project. So that, and when the first bomb was dropped or whatever, the purchasing guy called me up and said, "Now you know why, what's happening to your instruments. They were part of this program."
Oh, wow.
And he wanted to thank us for the efforts that we put in and that sort of thing. So that's why infrared got such an impetus right during the war, those two programs.
Mm. And so when did Van Zandt Williams come on board?
He came on about 1949, I would say. It was just, and he came on to supervise the infrared activity of the company.
Mm-hmm. And could you say a little bit more about him as a person and his contribution?
Well, he was an extremely likable person. He had a very pleasant personality. Everybody liked Van. He was not tremendously forceful. I mean, he was not the kind of person that would set goals and say, "We're going to do this, we're going to do that." But he was, from a scientific standpoint, tremendously interested in infrared. And that was his main contribution. He felt that it was a tremendously important technology, and anything that PerkinElmer could do to forward it and make it more widely used was important.
Mm-hmm.
And as I told you, he was instrumental in getting the Koblenz Society started, because he felt that there needed to be a strong group that would make sure that the quality of infrared work that was done was of the highest possible quality, which meant having high quality spectra available and instruments that were properly used and that sort of thing. It was possible if you set the controls wrong in a spectrometer like the Model 21, you could get what we call spurious absorption bands. You'd get overshoots, and you would get these bands that you try to interpret as part of a chemical bond and that sort of thing, when they were really an instrumental effect. And Van was very conscious that people should use the instruments properly so they didn't get this false information.
Mm.
And that was one of the things that he was trying to do in organizing the Koblenz group, to kind of watchdog the activities of infrared people.
And so we talked before how there was this unanticipated demand for the IR, for the Model 12. When and how did the idea emerge to start developing a double beam instrument, Model 21?
Well, that came because of the work that was done at Dow Chemical, Norman Knight's group. And when he publicized what they were doing, the instrument companies, all three of them, PerkinElmer, Beckman, and Baird, immediately descended on Dow. And Dow was very free to give out the information. They were not an instrument company. They just wanted to get an improvement in the instrumentation that was available to them to use. So all three companies visited Dow. Baird literally copied the exact model that Dow had developed. It was a big, very large instrument with a large rock salt prism and quite cumbersome and that sort of thing. PerkinElmer and Beckman really redesigned existing instruments that they had. Beckman had, I guess, the IR-2 at that time, and PerkinElmer had the Model 12, and the 21 was a redesign of the 12. It had the same basic monochromator, but it had a double beam system, so that it was a double beam instrument rather than a single beam instrument. But the same parabola and that sort of thing, rock salt prism was used in that instrument that was used in the Model 12.
Mm.
And Beckman's instrument, I guess, was the IR-4. Now, Beckman also had another instrument that was a memory instrument. In other words, you ran a spectrum on a tape, and then when you ran another an analytical spectrum after that, you ran it against the tape, so that it's precisely what is done today with an FTIR instrument. But it was really before its time, because it was very difficult to synchronize the tape. This was the IR-3. And Beckman gave it up and went to a straight double beam instrument like the PerkinElmer, which was the IR-4.
And could you talk about what was your role with developing the double beam instrument?
Really very little. At this stage, I had moved into sales and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did help put together the first one. Vince Coates and I assembled the first one because I knew how to put optics together, monochrome. I'll tell you a very interesting story about the Model 21. John White came out one day and watched me assembling a Model 12. And it turned out that I was the only one in the company that could make the slip mechanism adjust it so it functioned properly. And he watched me for a while and he said, "You're left-handed." And I said, "I'm left-handed, that's right, and that's why I could do this." He went back to his desk and turned his drawings upside down and reversed the flow in the Model 21. So if you look at the Model 21 today, the monochromator is on the left, and it's accessible from your right hand, whereas the Model 12 monochromator is on the right, and you can access it from the left hand. So that's why the two instruments are reversed. He had started designing them so that they were carbon copy of each other. So.
And who were the other key people as you saw in developing the 21?
Well, I think the basic work was John White and Max Liston. Max has developed the electronic side of it, and he'd already developed a high-speed thermocouple that was used in the Model 12, but he did the electronic design, and John White did the optical design and the mechanical layout. And as I said, Vince Coates was the principal designer. He did most of the drawings that were necessary to put the Model 21 together. And then he and I together assembled the first one and figured out why certain parts didn't fit. That sort of thing, you know, this is always the case with a new instrument. And we kind of worked together on it. And,
well, to stay at this time period, when you're involved in advertising and sales, we spoke earlier that you're visiting mostly chemical process firms. Were you meeting with the analytical chemists in those firms, in their research, or who was it that you were visiting at the firm?
Well, I think at this stage, most chemical companies had instrument groups that we dealt with primarily. They were typically analytical departments or segments of research departments where the basic instruments were kept. And these were the people that we talked with mostly. It wasn't until the lower priced, simpler instruments came along that they really spread out and went to the chemists and that sort of thing. We also, all three companies, participated in infrared schools that were held at MIT and Fisk University and University of Minnesota. These were annual affairs, and the instrument companies brought their equipment and taught people how to use them and that sort of thing. So that was a very major activity at that time.
To what extent, when you were, and this is, we're talking sort of 47, 48 here, into the early 50s, to what extent would you go meet with someone who's going to purchase one of them and kind of tweak the machine for their needs? Or was it really just
a single
sale?
Well, we didn't carry the instruments around with us.
Right.
They were too heavy. We tried to get people to come and visit us, and we did put on schools that would attract prospective spectroscopists, or we supported the university schools, and that's where a lot of the education took place. But it was mostly visiting and discussing applications with people. There was always a choice: should I buy a single beam instrument or a double beam instrument? And you'd kind of find out what was their basic application and that sort of thing, and then you would push them in the direction you thought was best for that particular situation.
Were there in this period from sort of, let's say, well, up until 57, with IR, did you see, were there important sort of lead users or lead sites that you were particularly interested in maintaining their connection to PerkinElmer, like DuPont?
Yes, definitely. And the big chemical companies, DuPont and Dow.
Right.
And SO, Shell, of course. Shell was primarily a Beckman company, but the Monsanto, all of the major chemical companies were very prime targets as far as we were concerned. So, as I said, DuPont was to us the leader at that stage. They were really ahead of most of the other companies in their use of infrared. And they had a group that met every once a month and discussed infrared applications and that sort of thing. And we were invited periodically to come and talk to them if we had some new development that they wanted to hear. And we also used them as kind of guinea pigs. If we had something new, we let them try it. If they liked it, we figured the rest of the industry would like it also. So,
I guess over, and I'd like to ask about if the market sort of divides into these sort of camps around in IR, you know, back, you know, Shell Emeryville, sort of a Beckman lead user site, DuPont for PerkinElmer, task about just the competition, the different competitors in this period in the IR market, Carey, Baird, and Beckman, and PerkinElmer was so successful during this period. If you could talk about
Well, Baird sort of dropped out of it. They were the first that backed away from infrared, although they were very active in mass spectroscopy visible spectroscopy. And Beckman, of course, was strong in the ultraviolet region. And I think PerkinElmer eventually really dominated the field. They probably had more than 60% of the total market. They were very slow in picking up FTIR. For a long time, they resisted going into the FTIR instruments, so that when they finally arrived, Brock and Nicolay had really established a very strong position in Bio-Rad. And I had left PerkinElmer at this stage, and I could never understand why they, I think they had were so successful at selling dispersive instruments that they didn't really want to make the effort to switch over and join the rest of the world. But they finally did, and I think today they're number two to Nicolay.
So, when we were talking about this sort of technical debate between PerkinElmer and Beckman on the focal length, mm-hmm. the F number, why was it, do you think, that Beckman was so committed to these longer focal lengths and PerkinElmer was?
Well, it's simply they didn't know how to make aspheric optics.
Okay.
I mean, they did not have the skill in their optical shop. They didn't need it for UV instruments. The UV instruments had plenty of energy, and they could use relatively long focal lengths, and they just didn't have the ability to make an off-axis parabola or an elliptical mirror to focus energy on the detector, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And that's the reason, basically. PerkinElmer was an optical company, and Beckman was a laboratory instrument company, and they just had different. They came from different directions.
Mm. One thing that we didn't talk about was sort of talked about the business history dimension of CIC, but we didn't cover that. For Will Scientific, how you put together the funding for that.
Well, that was a very fortunate thing. when I sell a company, I like to sell it for stock, you know, stock for stock deal. And I took Barnes stock for CIC stock, and shortly after I sold to Barnes, Bowling Barnes came up with a thermography, the way of measuring breast cancer by means of temperature. Barnes' skill was remote temperature measurement and that sort of thing, using infrared to measure temperature of transformers and that sort of thing. And Bowling Barnes came up with the idea of being able to spot malignant tumors by the temperature distance. So he developed this thermograph, and it got huge publicity, and the Barnes stock went from 5 to 36 in no time. And I had sold the company, and I took what is called letter stock, which was a stock that was not publicly traded and had not been registered by Barnes for public trading. And at that time I hired a lawyer take me down to the SEC in Washington and plead hardship that I was starting a company and I needed to be able to sell the stock so that I could raise money for the company and that sort of thing. And so we did all the stuff we had to do. And I remember I was visiting Johnson & Johnson in New Jersey when the receptionist called me and said, "You have a telephone call from your home office." And I picked up the phone. It was my secretary. And she said, "You've just received a no action letter, which means that the SEC will not take any action against you if you sell the stock." In other words, it meant that my stock was free. So the stock that I had traded the company for $5 a share was now worth $36, and I immediately called my broker and said, "I need money." So I sold a big chunk of the Barnes stock. After that, it went back to 12. And but that was one of the fortunate things that happened to me and gave me the finances to develop Brooks Scientific.
And did you keep that company private throughout?
Yes, although, as I mentioned, we did have an investment from EG&G, right, and then later on from International Nickel, and then ultimately I sold the whole company to Foxborough.
Right.
Again, that was a stock-for-stock situation, and Foxborough went through a merger situation which pushed their stock up too, so it turned out to be a fortunate happening for me. Mm-hmm.
And then at Wilkes Scientific, I forget the term that I'm supposed to use instead of selective
wavelength. Yeah.
Okay, I'm trying to switch my vocab. Did you make any selective wavelength gas analyzers?
Yes,
you did.
Oh yes, they were all based on filter technology.
Okay.
And we used either fixed filters or we used variable filters that we could rotate in front of the slit of the instrument to select a particular wavelength.
Okay.
But they were not spectrometers of the type that used a grating and a prism and that sort of thing.
Right. But some units, I guess maybe I'm not asking it right. Some analyzers you made specifically to look for
a specific wavelength,
specific characteristic wavelength,
yeah.
And others were more
versatile.
Versatile. There you go. Okay.
Right.
And those two lines of products were serving. Had different markets then?
Well, not really. If you wanted an instrument to look at a variety of different potential hazardous vapors in the atmosphere, then you wanted an instrument that you could select the wavelength. One time it would be this wavelength, one time it would be another. Often it was a case where you had a specific material and you just wanted a monitor to make sure that that particular material didn't get above a certain level. And that's where you would use a dedicated instrument that had just the right wavelength.
Right. I guess I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the trajectory of GCIR.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think most people are more familiar with a different sort of, instrumentality to be used as the detector for the or analyzer for the GC. I guess what I'd like to know is about what was the time period when GCIR was really hot or most used, and then what.
Well, I think it's still very hot. I mean,
okay.
But it was developing in the early 70s, almost as soon as GC came on over the horizon. It was apparent that there needed to be a method to characterize these various peaks that came off the chromatograph.
Mm-hmm.
And at GAC, we experimented with different kinds of sampling approaches where we could condense a peak onto an aluminum cup and let the gas disappear and the peak deposit. Then we would put it in the spectrometer and look at it by reflection. That was one of the first ways we did it. Later on, at Wilkes Scientific, we used ATR as an approach. We built a chamber that you could pass a gas from a chromatograph through. You could turn a valve when the peak appeared, and that particular peak would go through this system, and the plates were cooled by thermoelectric coolers so that we would condense on the surface of the ATR plate the material we're trying to identify. And then we would run a spectrum of that. That was another approach. And then finally we developed light pipes that had the same volume as a typical peak would have coming out of a chromatograph.
Mm-hmm.
And those were actual modifications of the spectrometer itself. We moved the optics back and put the light pipe in between the source optics and the entrance slits, and they became a cell, a long, thin cell, rectangular in shape because the slip, the beam in a dispersive instrument is rectangular rather than circular, and they were made by electroforming. We you know, you lay down a layer of gold, and then on top of that you lay down nickel, and you get a nice tube that is very highly polished inside and has a gold surface and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the, and that approach is still being used today, the light pipe approach. Although mass spectrometry has sort of taken over because it fits very nicely with GC, and it's probably, there's probably more GCMS done today than there is GCIR. So.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, in the early days of the General Analysis Corporation, I mean, you had a few years before you went into the direction of the beverage. And you said that it was partly a product of Reagan, mm-hmm. that it was unsuccessful in the sense of doing the environmental monitoring.
Right.
But did you do some of it? Did you have some clients where you went to their...
No. You know, it just did not take off.
Mm-hmm.
We tried it. We advertised it and did direct mail, and we never really created any clients. It was,
okay.
It was a total failure as far as... we were concerned, and so we switched over to try to build our own
right.
instrument.
How did you find, I mean, were there technical difficulties or challenges associated with going from the gas to the liquid?
Well, it's sample handling. That's the real difference. Everything else about the instrumentation is the same.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to measure infrared absorption at a specific wavelength, that sort of thing.
Right.
But the gas cell has to be a long path because molecules are dispersed widely, and liquids have to be a very short path because they're clumped together and they absorb infrared very strongly, so you can't have a long path cell.
Mm-hmm.
That's the advantage of ATR, because you have a very short effective path length with an ATR system, and therefore you're in the right absorption range to look at liquids and solids and that sort of thing. But the same detectors are used, the same filters are used, the same dispersive elements, you know, used. We had an interesting situation at GAC because we had developed a liquid analyzer. And again, I had a telephone call from DuPont, and they invited me down and they said, we're coming out with a new refrigerant, and it's turned out to be mildly toxic, so we need to have sensors that we can supply, and you guys know something about gas analysis, although GC was not at all in gas analysis at that time. And I looked at our LAM system, which had about a 3-inch crystal in it that was in. I remember I was walking down the 14th fairway at the country club, and it suddenly dawned on me how I could make a gas cell that would have a folded path and would fit into the same space that we had in to do a lipid analysis. And we developed this gas cell, which we got a patent on, which is a very simple cylinder with flat ends and gold, all gold plated inside, and the beam mounted back and forth, and it gives us about almost a meter path and about a 3-inch length. Mm. So we could stick that right in the land system, and I showed that to DuPont, and they said, boy, this is great. That's just what we wanted to do, except it costs about 3 times as much as we can afford. So we totally redesigned the system and came up with a gas analyzer that was used for refrigerant monitoring. And it was a very successful instrument for a while until we got some competition from MSA.